For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. We tend to take on the beliefs and behaviors of those whom we respect and look up to. We emulate them. And most of the time, this works out well. Having someone to look up to helps one navigate the world, builds the framework for character. But what happens when that framework is built by a character who believes that the world is doomed to be destroyed by a zombie apocalypse? That's some shaky structure. And for any one of us that would have to live as a child within it, we might become a little shaky ourselves. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. A created monster. The boy in the interrogation room is whispering, as if he wants to be invisible. A long history of abuse and neglect has taught this tactic. A whispering child, a silent little boy, or girl, is less likely to draw the ire of their abuser. Something that 14-year-old Eldon Samuel III claims to have been unable to avoid this night. And what day is it? March 24th of 2014. And where are we? Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Good. Good job, son. Young Eldon could be forgiven if he were confused. His father had moved them no less than 20 times following eviction after eviction, most recently from California to Idaho, far from the mother of his two boys. Well, one boy. Now, Eldon has a way about him that makes it seem as if he's not quite there. Mentally, sure, but physically, too. He's small for 14, malnourished. If he were to smile, which he won't, you might think I'm holding a mouthful of caramels, but it's just a mess of rotting teeth. The kid wants to disappear, and sometimes it feels like he just might. Eldon Samuel III could pop out of existence, and it would surprise nobody. Dark, greasy hair, sweat-slicked and sallow skin, the fidgety movements of an uncomfortable soul beneath said skin. A look into his eyes is difficult, as Sheldon shifts them away so frequently. But for the brief moments where he locks in, those eyes tell a story. A look into his history with Child Protective Services tells the rest. His mother and father were addicted to pills. Eldon's mother had been in a car accident, and his father had hurt his shoulder badly at work. They lived in squalor, all over California. Eldon was born in 1999, and his younger brother Jonathan arrived 11 months later. It soon became obvious that the younger boy was developmentally delayed. This put more strain on an already strung-out household. Eventually, Eldon's younger brother would be diagnosed as severely autistic. Things were never normal for Eldon, though he wanted, badly, for them to be. It would anger him when Jonathan had a fit. Eldon felt that his brother's disability made things worse than what they needed to be, and he was right. It's not all Jonathan's fault, of course, but in a home where two junkie parents are at each other's throats, Eldon felt that his younger brother Jonathan constantly charged the situation. And though his father could be abusive, he never took it in on Jonathan. Jonathan was protected. He had an excuse. And Eldon would suffer what couldn't be doled out on his brother, though he'd earned it, in Eldon's mind, by creating the tension in the family, by his disability. This is how Eldon felt. And again, I can't say he was wrong to feel this way. What was wrong was the environment. One where Eldon saw his mother abused by his mentally disturbed father in front of him and his severely, as they say, autistic younger brother. His mother wasn't quite right either. Suicidal at times, leaving for psychiatric hospital stints on occasion, but who could blame her? With stories such as those in the child services notes. At age 4, Eldon witnessed his father douse his mother with lighter fluid, then threaten to burn her alive if she didn't sign over a settlement check she received from her car accident. Speaking of car accidents, at age 6, the boy watched as his father ran his mother over with a car, I believe in the driveway, likely of some cockroach-infested trailer home, while his brother stimmed out on the lawn. And I don't mean to be rude here, but this is the way it was. This is the way it was for this family. You have Eldon, who is quote-unquote normal, his younger brother, just by 11 months, severely autistic. And then you have a mother and a father running the fucking thing, who are both junked and on drugs. The mother got hit by the car by the fucked up father and suffered injuries, bruises, scrapes, also a broken collarbone. And this is just what's been documented to this point. Every day was a horror movie for Eldon and his brother, no doubt, though he just didn't really know what was going on with his disability. He was just kind of doing his thing, and for Eldon, he was looking around and seeing everybody as fucked up. Like, what the fuck is going on here? I just want me and my mom and my dad, and my brother is freaking out all over the house, and now dad's mad at mom and mom's mad at dad, and it's gotta be Jonathan that's causing this, because every time he freaks out, they eventually freak out, and then they beat on me for their frustration with him. This is how he deduces it. His father believed that the world would end soon in a zombie apocalypse. Just to let you know how fucked up this is. I mean, the result of too much television it was and not enough intelligence. Their trailer would always be stocked with guns, knives, and ammo rather than food. Eldon and his father would sometimes eat only once a day. But every day was a horror movie. His father obsessed over zombie films and video games, encouraging his children to obsess along with him. By the time they moved to Idaho to get away from the overpopulated and fertile zombie grounds of California, Eldon had become as convinced as his father that the end times were any minute. Eldon, our subject here, you know, he's, I don't know, 10 at the time now, says goodbye to his mother. She doesn't make the trip. She fled the situation soon after the last documented Samuel family incident. Last before the big one that I'm getting to, that is. Eldon's father had pointed a gun at Eldon's mother, Tina, and forced her into a chair, which he duct-taped her to. 10-year-old Eldon was then demanded to urinate on his mother, which he did, though he loved her. And who knows what else happened there? I mean, if the dad is going to degrade the mother to the point where he gets his son to piss on his mom, what else was he doing to her throughout that? That might not be documented. That likely is not documented. And she soon left. Child Protective Services were aware of the situation, but the father managed to keep them off his case. Mom was gone. Mom was nuts. He had his hands full with their developmentally challenged youngest, Jonathan. The other boy, Eldon, his junior, Eldon Senior's junior, and then there's Senior Senior, there's three of them. He was fine. Look at him. He seems fine. He's quiet. He's sitting there playing his video games, smoking zombies, getting practiced up. Sure, young Eldon had had multiple visits to the doctor for nausea, migraines, blurred vision, and insomnia, but perhaps a move to the middle of nowhere would help. Away from his mother, who was already gone. Alone with his severely autistic brother and mentally ill father in a shitty trailer, where the zombies were less likely to strike first, into the hills of Idaho they go. It'll be much better out there. And so they went. And that's how 14-year-old Eldon Gale Samuel III ended up in an interrogation room, looking as if he could simply disappear at any moment. What day is it again? March 24th, 2014, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, trailer 1311 of the St. Vincent de Paul Transitional Housing Community. There's a camper in the yard and a black-lifted truck. Neighbors to this point hadn't noticed much out of place. The fathers and sons kept to themselves. Yes, the one boy had a disability of some sort. Him and the other could be seen going to the camper on the property on occasion. The father sometimes would shoot his guns into the woods, but a lot of folks shot guns around there, and a lot of kids kept quiet in such parts, for fear of being seen. That's what happened, according to Eldon. His father had seen him. And since he'd been hopped up on pills, the whipping soon began. But who can know for sure exactly how or why this nightmare unfolded? Eldon hated his brother, feared and likely resented his father for the absence of his mother. They'd screwed everything up. So when Eldon II starts shooting into the woods, this is the father, for the second time this fateful late afternoon, Eldon III, the son, demands his father cut it out. Does he want to get them kicked out yet again? Dad, do you want us to have to move? Again. I'm barely back in school. They're making fun of me, sure, but it's not as bad as it was back in California. Shut the fuck up, kid. This is how it begins. And when the father and son begin arguing, Jonathan, despite his disability, knows exactly what to do. He runs to his room and hides under the bed. It's a bed with a thin pink cover on it that has a Dalmatian emblazoned upon it. Eldon is being pushed around in the living area of the trailer. Zombie posters adorn the walls. A mug trembles on a table full of weapons. On it is printed the words, "This is my zombie-killing mug." Young Eldon decides that yes, this is the night of the zombies and their extermination from his life. When his father puts down his .45 automatic handgun, Eldon picks it up and shoots Dad in the stomach. It's surreal. His father is yelling, "You've killed me! You've killed me, Eldon!" Eldon soon silences him with three shots to the head. They are at the entrance to the boy's bedroom. That's where Dad had been dragging himself to protect his other boy, Jonathan. Eldon would later admit that Jonathan was afraid of him. Not the father, but of him, young Eldon. There was likely abuse there between the brothers, and rarely is there not abuse between brothers, but we have a kid who's developmentally disabled, and we have Eldon who is full of anger and hate. Jonathan will not come out from under the bed. So Eldon gets a shotgun and fires at the mattress. The helpless boy is hit in the leg, Jonathan, and he tells his brother this, "Ow, my leg, Eldon! Eldon, ow, my leg!" Eldon, in a rage, demands Jonathan get out from under the bed. "Get out! What's wrong with you? Get out from there!" But Jonathan is too scared. He's shot in the leg. The poor kid feels safe beneath the bed. He can see his father, dead, at the door. And he sees his brother bouncing around the room around him, grabbing weapons, screaming at him. He can't move, hands likely over his ears, praying for it all to go away. He only begins moving, does Jonathan, when Eldon rips off the mattress and begins stabbing Jonathan through the slats of the bed. It's a brutal, ruthless attack. He may have snapped when killing his father, but this assault on his developmentally disabled younger brother is unforgivable. Eldon switches to a machete, and finally Jonathan begins to scurry out. Once his head appears, Eldon slams the machete down into the back of it. Blood splashes out and over the killer. He hacks away until his younger brother is unrecognizable. Then, calls 911. When police arrive, they find Eldon on the porch. He's speckled with blood and calmly tells the officers that his brother and father are inside. Initially, they believe the boy to be in shock after having found them this way. Maybe there'd been a robbery. But it soon becomes obvious that something is wrong with Eldon. It's in his eyes. And they put him in a squad car before he's able to disappear. In the interrogation room, the young man attempts to blame his brother's death on his father. He claims an attack from Dad had forced him to defend himself. And unfortunately, he couldn't save his brother after he killed his father, where and before his father had killed his brother. But the evidence tells the real story, and it doesn't take much to get the truth. Eldon Samuel III, 14 years old, seems to not really care either way. You don't buy it? You don't buy my shitty little story? Okay. I won't bother trying to sell it anymore. You want the truth? Sure. Why not? Can I get a hamburger or something? I'm hungry. I only get fed once a day. He doesn't seem to understand the gravity of the situation as he munches down French fries and takes a small bite of his burger. He asks when he can go home. Asks who will watch him. Maybe Mom? He looks forward to playing video games. There's a sense that Eldon Samuel III is relieved he won't have to worry about his dad or suffer his brother anymore. He seems light. 2 years later in court at the age of 16, he's a little heavier in weight. Eldon's eyes look clear. Whatever has been his experience in the juvenile system seems to have served him well. Three squares, a little bit of exercise, some therapy. His mother begs for mercy for her remaining child. The prosecution wants Eldon to serve time in an adult prison. The defense wants him in juvie until he's 21, then a shot at probation. Even though it's clear that the state of Eldon has improved, the judge can't get past what he did to his brother, and the boy receives 20 years in adult prison. He can't risk Eldon harming another boy in juvie. Eldon Samuel takes the stand to make a statement. He looks clear. The boy no longer shimmers, as if he may just disappear. Before he's put away, no doubt to a world that will change him greatly over the next couple of decades, Eldon has this to say. Quote, "I feel like a whole new person, but that doesn't excuse what I did." End quote. His mother promises to stay with him, in contact, and to never give up on him. Then, Eldon Samuel III disappears, likely to return around the year 2036. Unless the zombies get to us first. A created monster.
On the northwest corner of 128th Street and 5th Avenue in New York City's Harlem, you'll find a small gated park that seems odd and out of place. Collier Park sits where a once proud brownstone stood, the so-called Collier Mansion, that was torn down, ironically, after an odd and out of place duo finally wore out their welcome there. The Collier Brothers. Welcome to Marooned, Stories of the Catastrophically Lost. I'm Jack Luna. This is Aaron Habel.
Meet Langley Collier, the younger of the infamous Collier brothers, born in 1885. Langley, like his older brother Homer, would grow up to be an eccentric, offbeat character, though he was an excellent piano player and would eventually become a dealer of the bulky instruments. Langley was a wily little man, something from a Dickens novel. With his bushy mustache like that of a wise old gopher and paddy cap pulled low over his eyes.
And I don't know if everyone knows what a paddy cap is. Picture what they wear in the show Peaky Blinders, a newsboy cap. This is beyond the era that we're in, this reference here, Aaron, but Langley looks to me like Andy Cap, that old British comic strip character, always getting pulled around by his ear, by his wife. Though Andy Cap was without the wild mustache and towering IQ that Langley Collier possessed.
Yeah, he was bright, Jack. Too bright, perhaps. Shining intelligence seems to attract madness at times, especially in tales from this era.
Yeah, like I think Edgar Allan Poe, early 19th century. That's, of course, earlier than our story, but I feel it's where these brothers live or want to live. So they dress and live and act the part.
Langley Collier earned an engineering degree from Columbia, which would never lead to employment, only drive hobbies and experiments of his, which we will get to. But first...
First, meet Homer Collier, born in 1881. The older, equally eccentric brother, who, like Langley, enjoyed dressing as if from a bygone era. Picture Ebenezer Scrooge with the top hat and old heavy coat, bushy sideburns, long curly hair cascading away from the baldness such men wore so well. Homer would become a Manhattan lawyer, an occupation that made his parents proud. The Collier brothers came from a proud family lineage and had deep roots in American history. Family legend was that their ancestors had come over on the Speedwell, an English ship they claimed should have arrived before the Mayflower. But the Mayflower stole their wind. And this is the kind of off-the-wall stuff we're dealing with when it comes to the Collier clan, Aaron. Stole their wind. Like, beep, beep, get out of the way, Mayflower. Can you believe this guy up here? He's stealing our wind over here. Like, there are a couple of taxi cabs in a New York street. But it's the Mayflower. We don't want to get too bogged down in the history of the family. What we should mention is that their father was a gynecologist and their mother was an opera singer. Finally, something relatable here, Aaron.
Well, relatable if your father carried a canoe to the city river and paddled to work downtown every day, Jack.
Which he did. Not my dad, but the Collier patriarch. Yeah, he rode a canoe to work, portaging first through traffic in New York City with it.
Eccentric is the word of the episode. The Collier brothers would lose both their father and their mother in 1923 and 1929, respectively. It is after the eldest brother, Homer, begins suffering the effects of rheumatoid arthritis while being struck with blindness that things really take a strange turn. Langley retreats to the family brownstone to care for his brother Homer. Money is not an issue due to their ample inheritance. And the Collier brothers, for a time, disappear from the public eye.
But the Collier mansion soon becomes a fascination. And I must say, calling it a mansion seems like a stretch. This is a very large brownstone townhouse, typical of upper-class areas like Harlem at the time, and today with its gentrification. Though there was a period, just as the Colliers retreat to their so-called mansion, when the Great Depression hit, housing prices crashed, and Harlem transformed into more of a ghetto. This, of course, heightened the paranoia of the Collier brothers. Suddenly, their windows were being broken, and their home became a target for burglars.
Jack, you say heightened their paranoia, but I'm not sure we distinguished well enough yet that aspect to this tale. This brownstone townhouse is four stories tall and probably has the capacity to house multiple families. While the residences around them are sold or transformed into apartments, the Collier brothers stayed put. And in comparison to the living conditions of those around them, this is a mansion. The reason the brothers don't leave is because they don't feel like they can. In the years following their decision to hunker down and have Langley care for his ailing brother, Homer, Langley has filled the mansion with, well, junk. He's what you'd refer to today as a hoarder.
Yeah, it's the loss of the parents, then older brother Homer's loss of sight and mobility. This has spun the youngest brother Langley into a form of madness here, it seems. Much of what he uses to fill the massive brownstone, or the mansion, appears to be newspapers. Homer sits in a comfortable chair deep in the depths of the mansion. You've convinced me to call it a mansion, Aaron. And Langley begins collecting junk and creating mazes of garbage and newspapers through said mansion. Initially, he tells himself that the papers are for his brother to read once he cures his brother's blindness. But it's eventually clear that the mansion is simply being transformed into a nest of sorts for the brothers.
Yes, there's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, literally. I mean, it seems to me, Aaron, that the brother Langley is actually hoarding his brother, too, keeping him in the middle of the mansion. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, yes. All we have to do is look back at what their careers were. Mm-hmm. I mean, Langley didn't have one. He did play piano, and he played it in front of crowds. His mother was an opera singer. It seemed like the brothers did as their mother instructed them. So the older brother, he became an attorney. It's, you know, whenever you think, oh, what will my kids grow up to be? There are definitely families out there that say, oh, I want my kid to grow up to be a doctor or a lawyer. Well, that's what happened here. Mm-hmm. And Homer became the lawyer. But then Langley, it seems, followed in his mother's footsteps. He wasn't a singer, but he could play piano. Mm-hmm. And there's something odd about this, where before all this went awry and they became shut-ins, Langley had seen another person playing piano, and I don't recall their name, but it reminded me of the book American Psycho, if anyone has read that, where literally you have the main character, and if he's out and about and he sees someone who's stronger looking than him, more fit, he will be driven to go and work out. Doesn't matter if he has a business meeting coming up. But in this case, Langley heard and saw this other piano player and said, why am I doing this? This person's better than me. It's the opposite approach.
Mm, gotcha. That's very interesting. Something else before we move on here too to mention is that I get the sense that the older brother Homer, you know, he becomes blind. The rheumatoid arthritis limits his mobility entirely at a certain point. I get the sense after the parents die that Homer becomes like the hive mind. Like it's like he's the brain in the middle of this massive junk in this mansion. And he's kind of sending Langley out to do not his bidding, but a lot of people get the feeling that Langley was the one who had gone kind of mad here. I feel like Homer was the one who may have gone mad as well and was kind of sent. Do you get that sense about this story, Aaron, that he's kind of pulling the strings here?
Yes, I get the feeling, too, from reading through the materials that Langley very much respected his older brother. Mm-hmm. And that's why he wanted to take care of him as well, not just because they were brothers, but he very much respected him. He respected his father and his mother as well. Mm-hmm. But yes, very much so. When he would go out, he would collect a lot of newspapers. And like you said, it was so his older brother could read once he got his sight back. Mm-hmm. When we say he collected a lot of newspapers, he collected every single kind you can imagine every day for decades.
Yeah. I started laughing at that, and I shouldn't, because I mean, this is obviously something going on here with like a form of mental illness, right? But it's just the way you said it there. Like it is a lot of newspapers. I mean, we're talking like 100 tons of them.
Yeah. And we'll get into what else was collected, but it really was the thing that he would collect. He always made sure to collect every kind of newspaper so his brother would eventually get caught up on the news of the world. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the rheumatoid arthritis of Homer Langley. It's quite severe. Homer is most often dressed in a blue and white bathrobe, holding his knees to his chest in his chair to relieve the pain. He lives in this chair as he's unable to walk or even lie down. Rheumatoid arthritis affects the lining of your joints, causing a painful swelling that can eventually result in bone erosion and joint deformity. It seems that Homer Collier suffered from a serious case. Brother Langley would bathe, feed, and entertain Homer.
Yeah, he'd feed him 100 oranges a week and read to Homer from the vast library of their fathers. That's 100 oranges a week. I'm just kind of skirting past that. That's a lot of freaking oranges. But that's what they both believed would eventually bring back his sight and some of his mobility. In the vast library that they had in the home, they would read Shakespeare, Dickens, Poe, maybe Mary Shelley, Walter Scott. The brothers had access to thousands of medical books as well. And for this reason, Langley never saw any reason, or neither did Homer, to seek a medical professional for what was going on with Homer Collier. Langley was the sole caretaker, and from what we could tell, Homer wanted it this way. Langley, dressed like a vagabond, would usually only leave his brother's side at night. He'd use this time to collect food from bodegas, though he wasn't above dumpster diving, and more often than not would return with some junk he'd found out there. A broken tricycle and a half-eaten ham sandwich. score one for the rich guys, Aaron.
Well, even though they had access to wealth, especially in comparison to the community growing around them, the Collier brothers lived a squalid existence. Rumors swirled that the brothers had money and treasure hidden in their mansion, and it became necessary for Langley to begin worrying for their safety. Windows around the brownstone were being smashed by neighborhood kids. The front door was broken into on more than one occasion. Homer Collier, growing older, sicker, and more mentally disturbed due to the news on the radio and the stories from the street Langley would share, orders Langley to lock them down, wire the doors and windows shut, then board them up. Langley is way ahead of him. Homer can't see the condition of their formerly proud family brownstone. It's unrecognizable.
The electricity was shut off around the year 1930. Older brother Homer is now 50 years old, while Langley is in his mid-40s. Both look ancient, like ghosts from a bygone era. It is the stuff of an old Poe story. The immobile older brother, blind and tortured with a physical affliction that has him locked to his lounge chair, sat near a fireplace, serenaded by an old radio, served tea straight to the lips by his doting brother, a madman who fills the mansion with perceived treasures. Langley claimed that the utility was paid, but that the services were shut off by Consolidated Edison because it was dangerous to continue giving them services. He didn't see any of this risk, did Langley Collier? And out of sheer stubbornness, the mansion begins being lit by kerosene lanterns. Both brothers are insanely cheap considering their means. Langley, the inventor with a dusty engineering degree, begins dismantling and repurposing their father's old Ford Model T into something that could generate electricity. And it kind of works, but it's too much work to maintain. Langley wrote down everything his brother said in the middle of the night. I mention this to share the reverence the older brother earned from the younger and maybe further put home some of the madness brewing here.
Jack, you mentioned the appearance of both brothers, but I think it's important to note that Langley claimed his appearance was to shield him from robberies or stabbings. He looked to have no wealth and also looked pathetic. So who would attack him? Langley would sneak out at night to find stuff from garbage bins, like you said. He would also feed cats. Their mansion had strays all through it and around it, as well as rats. Kids who would see the younger Collier brother sneaking around in the late hours would call him Spook. Others called him Ghosty Man. One put a sign on Langley's door that read, "This is a ghost house."
Rosetta Stone, everybody. Rosetta Stone is a leading language learning program available on desktop and mobile designed to fully immerse you in your chosen language for a more natural and effective learning experience. I use Rosetta Stone. And my favorite aspect of Rosetta Stone is how you can learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally. It helps you think and communicate with confidence. There's no English translation, so you truly learn how to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. They have an intuitive learning process. You start with words, you build to phrases, and you progress to full sentences. And it's designed for long-term retention, so what you learn sticks with you. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
The place and the brothers had earned quite the reputation. Those burglars previously mentioned who were able to gain entry would soon find themselves stymied by a wall of junk. Langley had created a labyrinth of mazes that led to empty rooms, and these mazes were only accessible by finding hidden hatches within the walls of newspaper and junk. Even if one were to find themselves on their way to what can only be described as the nest, surrounded by shrunken hallways of junk, papered like a hive, even if a burglar managed to suffer the smells and claustrophobic conditions to make any headway towards the brothers' main room in the mansion, where rumor is that treasure awaited, there were booby traps along the way, as well as alarms of tin cans strung about. Of course, there was no real treasure anyways. Most of the money was in the bank.
Speaking of the bank wanted their money, all $6,700 of it. The mortgage had gone unpaid since 1931, which would be less than 2 years since the death of their mother. The brothers were ordered to appear in court to argue why they should not be evicted. They didn't show. The bank foreclosed the mortgage. Langley said that he couldn't leave his brother alone until he was asleep. He also said his brother couldn't sign papers. This is why the mortgage wasn't being paid. But he knew he had to do something because Homer would not want their house taken away. He didn't know what was happening. The McMullen Law Office attempted to help the brothers. They set up an offer to repurchase the home from the bank. But Langley didn't open the letters to inform him of this plan from the attorney. Lawyer McMullen himself went to the mansion when he'd heard rumor of a ruckus and found a mailbox stuffed with mail and a crowd of about 500 people watching a crew attempt to clean the property. And Langley shouted from the house for people to stop the thieves. It was a mad scene. The crowds were thrilled to see the odd character poke his head from a window, cap pulled low, but those wild, beady eyes blazing from beneath, and above that wild, bushy mustache. The thieves or crew had been sent from the bank. They wanted the property picked up and the brothers evicted. Police inquired, and since there was no proof that the bank had sent the workers, they were made to leave. The crowd seemed to support Langley and shouted words of encouragement.
Months later, another attempt was made by the bank to take the property back. Several lawyers, a banker, a sheriff, and two deputies, multiple firemen with a hook and ladder, two cars of police officers, a doctor, and a locksmith showed up. The commotion brought about 1,000 onlookers. Lawyer McMullen banged on the door to get Langley's attention, but there was no answer. The sheriff gave the go-ahead to the firemen to break in. As they went door to door to break into the mansion, they met the same obstacles. Even after breaking doors and windows, there was so much junk piled that access was seemingly impossible. It was said that one team took 3 hours to get 2 feet into one room. They exited covered in dust. It seemed as though eviction wasn't in the cards.
Langley's voice was eventually heard by lawyer McMullen, who was able to locate him in a room filled with pianos. Langley could hardly be seen but for his trademark cap. The lawyer informed him of the money owed to the bank. In response, Langley held his hand high, long heavy coat sleeve drooping like a wizard's. The filthy hand was waving a large wad of cash. Here's the $6,700. This brought a welcome end to the drama. The fire department and law enforcement personnel had had enough. The bank got paid. Their lawyer, though, still had much to discuss with Langley. But how can you deal with someone lost in over 100 tons of junk, spread across many rooms in a mansion with no electricity and no phone, not to mention, despite the night journeys that he would go on, never checked his mailbox? Langley never seemed to check this mailbox or come out of the brownstone unless under cover of night. He was like a mouse, a brilliantly mad little mouse. The truth was that the brothers were owed a lot of money by the city and for billboards they owned and rented out. They also had numerous bank accounts with thousands of dollars that they could access, but didn't. Like we've mentioned, they were quite stubborn and frugal. The IRS wanted unpaid back taxes settled by Homer, but he was in no shape to deal with the situation. This resulted in the loss of the building at 2077 Fifth Avenue, right next door. They had owned that building, but it was auctioned off. The property was of no interest to anyone, so the government bought it for $100. The government tried to get Langley to buy it back in December of 1944, But McMullen, now the brother's attorney, said buying it would mean that the Colliers would have to pay back taxes on it to the tune of $5,000. Langley and Homer would never agree to that. The government could keep their prize.
Yeah, their booby prize, Aaron. And speaking of boobies, I want to talk more about the booby traps and oranges mentioned earlier. That's, after all, kind of why we're here. For boobies. The traps are large walls of junk set with tripwire, or simply held up with wooden boards. If tripped, then the intruder would be trapped under a pile of heavy garbage. The oranges, I just can't get over. To think of this poor afflicted man being tended to by his loving yet unstable brother and being fed nothing but oranges. That's not entirely true. There was peanut butter and crackers too. There was water Langley got from a public water pump. But the situation, Aaron, is incredible. It's the stuff of fiction. Exactly the type of fiction these aging brothers would enjoy together, Langley reading each night to his brother by candlelight. The Collier brothers are, after all this fuss and circumstance, effectively marooned in their own mansion. They disappear from public view, left to do what they will with their time, and their private life becomes legend.
Friday, July 26th, 1946. Langley Collier is seen for the first time in 4 years as he arrives at court via the subway. He would have been held in contempt had he not shown up. A 25-year-old man had been arrested for breaking into the former residence of the Collier brothers, the building next to theirs, which was why Langley was required to appear. While the man was charged with burglary and a $2,500 bail was set, Langley was of great interest to the media, who bombarded him with an array of questions. When asked about the atomic bomb, Langley responded, "Atomic fission? Claptrap. That was simply nitrogen gas released by nature. Figured it out from medical books left by my father. He was a doctor."
It'll be a little less than a year following this wild public performance that the brothers will be in the public eye once again.
And I have to tell you, Jack, this whole media sensation that occurred here, it was wild. All the newspapers covered him. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't wait to ask him questions. I think this is why, while they were bizarre, the neighborhoods loved him. The people loved him because they couldn't wait to hear what they would say. So when you have Langley saying that atomic fission was simply nitrogen gas released by nature, they ate this stuff up. They loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was, there's a picture of him showing up at the window. You know, they're all boarded up, but he's at the window and he's talking down to the officers. And what a character, right? And I think everybody probably cheers when they see him as well. So these aren't two reclusive brothers that the neighborhood is afraid of, or, you know, they call it the ghost house, but that's kind of like the kids. These two are probably, they're a great fascination, but they're probably revered in a certain way. So back in that time, you know, you had bank robbers and such that would become heroic because of how people felt the banks were treating them. The brothers here are resisting what everybody else in society is being forced to do here. And I think that they probably have a lot of people looking up to them in a certain way, maybe.
Yeah, there's an appreciation there. Mm-hmm. But it reminds me of Monty Python and the Life of Brian, where Brian will show up and the crowds will be just singing his praises and calling for him to speak. And he's telling them, go away.
Yeah.
Go away. But well, they love it. They can't wait to see and hear from him. And he's a treasure. But to him, he's just annoyed.
Yeah.
Just like Langley is.
which makes them love him even more, right? So Friday, March 21st, 1947, Homer unfortunately dies at the age of 65. A man who gave his name as Charles Smith placed a call to inform police of a dead man at the Collier Brothers mansion. When asked who was dead, the caller gave the name Homer Collier. This gave the police a good reason to swarm the nest, the so-called ghost house, the Collier Mansion of Harlem.
And I have to jump in here real quick, Jack, because at the time, and I've gone through a lot of the newspapers from back then from New York, and there were varying accounts of the ages of these brothers. And it seemed like everyone was quick to publish stories before really checking their information. So you talk about a lot to weed through, but their ages varied from 60s to 70s. And then you also had people saying things like, oh, there was a woman mentioned in this document or whatever, and we're trying to figure out who she was. And it was like, no, that's their mother.
Yeah, right. So
as you go through all this information, as time goes on, they start to figure it out. But especially in the thick of things, there was a lot of different information coming out from different newspapers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
5 years before, an officer named John Collins had asked Bilette in the mansion to verify that Homer was alive. Langley Collier had surprisingly agreed. Now, Officer Collins had brought a flashlight with him. This came in very handy as there was no electricity in the building. Langley slowly guided him through a maze of trash to his brother. And when I say slowly, I mean this took quite a long time. This wasn't a 10-minute walk. Led this officer to his brother, who was indeed alive, although cantankerous. Homer, blind and stiffly curled up in his chair, demanded to know the officer's name and badge number. This had been the last time anyone had seen the older brother alive.
A sizable crowd gathered as a crew of police and city workers prepared to enter the boarded-up mansion. They knew from previous experience that this would not be a simple welfare check. Everyone wanted to know what happened to the brothers, to know if one of them was deceased. The authorities hacked open the front door, which caused a foul odor to spill out. The entire room before them was filled with junk. Langley, over the years, had packed the entranceways tight with trash. They got to work hacking at the plug in the front of the house. Is how I saw it described, Aaron, was like a plug that he plugged up all the doorways, just with mainly newspaper here. And they're hacking at this initial plug. The task seems impossible from the start. It's overwhelming, just as Langley had hoped. About 90 minutes in, an officer who had used a ladder to get access to a second-story window alerted the others. He had found one of the Collier brothers, and he appeared to be deceased.
The officer had discovered the Collier's main lair, surrounded by mountains of junk, curled in his chair, a blue and white bathrobe draped over him. Homer sat with his knees pulled up to his chin. His head and facial hair had not been attended to in years and was snow white. He looked emaciated. The ground was littered with shriveled orange peels. Officers removed him via the entry window in a khaki bag, which they lowered to the ground. It was believed that he had died of starvation. After an autopsy, the cause of death was listed as neglect. The brothers had been close, but the house was a maze. Did they lose contact with each other? Where was Langley? Had he gone mad and deserted Homer, left him to die?
Monday, March 24th, 1947. The Collier Mansion was searched by authorities. Homer Collier had just died days before, and a deadline had been set for the 24th at 1:30 p.m. to break into the mansion in an effort to locate the remaining brother. The plan was well publicized, and while they didn't hear from Langley, the public as well as the media responded. Approximately 2,000 spectators and media personnel showed up, all eyes on the mansion to see what would happen. Vendors made their way around the crowds to sell sodas and hot dogs. This was a circus. Frank Frostensky Jr., Assistant Chief Inspector in command of the Manhattan Police Force, was in charge of the situation, and he had 40 uniformed men carry out his orders. Emergency Squad 6 was there to provide support in case of injuries sustained by officers. After all, as they would see with their own eyes, the Collier Brothers mansion was filled floor to ceiling with stuff, not to mention booby traps.
John R. McMullen, the Collier Brothers attorney, had gone to the Bellevue Hospital morgue to formally identify the body of Homer Collier. He had also signed off on Langley Collier being a missing person, and he and the family had given the authorities permission to enter the mansion to look for this remaining Collier brother. This mansion had no gas, no electricity, not even a phone, and was filled with items from floor to ceiling on every level. It's a very precarious situation. The brothers had accumulated many things over the years, and it was said that they had never thrown anything away. Entry to the third floor was made via a skylight that had to be removed. Access to the skylight was gained by searchers making their way from an adjoining building. A siren broadcast from the West 123rd Street Police Station let them know it was time to enter. Each room was sifted through, with some items being tossed from windows, while other items were cataloged and set aside. Those inside the building couldn't work for more than 10 or 15 minutes due to the stench. And you know what? This was quite a situation because as they're going through everything in this building, most of it seems like junk. They're just tossing it out windows, and then crews are carrying it away and loading it onto trucks. But at some point, this mission leader, as you could call him, says, wait a minute, we're going to need to really make sure if there's anything valuable that we set that aside, that we catalog it, because it belongs to the family or there are costs here. They need to make sure they're just not throwing everything away, because as they're going through it, most of the stuff smells and looks so bad, they figure most of it's junk. But yep. You know what? This family did have money. There might be valuables. Now, one thing that's a little overlooked is the skeleton that was found. The fact that their father was heavily interested in medicine and a doctor himself might normalize the skeleton's presence. But this skeleton, it wasn't bleached and prepared like you might imagine.
No, Aaron, it looks like the skin is on it still.
Yeah, some say that it could be the corpse of a burglar who was caught in one of Langley's traps, then put in the box it was found in.
What do you think about that, Aaron? So you've seen that picture, as I have too. Initially, it didn't strike me that way until I read something about that. I'm like, wow, man, it really does look like somebody died in that house and they were stuffed in a box. Do you feel that maybe they caught a burglar?
Well, I don't know that they caught a burglar. It's
right.
I guess in a way they did, because think about it like a spider. It's setting its traps with the webs. And that's what they did.
Oh, man.
But since they didn't throw anything away, I don't see them tossing a body out of the building, right?
I
they save everything, even the bodies of burglars. So wow. I think that's possible.
That's an amazing way to put it, man. I didn't think about that. Because, yeah, this whole time I'm picturing it like Homer in the middle. He's like the hive mind, and Langley's went out doing his bidding. They even have tin cans strung together to alert them when someone's coming through the house. So that is so apt to say like a spider, because the tin cans jingling is just like how a spider feels its web jingling when it's caught something, you know? That is freaky. So it's a mystery, you know? It's messed up. This skeleton here with the skin hanging off of it still, dried. It looks like leather. It looks like a bat, old bat wings on it almost. The items inside the mansion are too numerous to list besides the skeleton here. It's super disturbing that they're finding a corpse. But the other items included are 3 bicycles, 6 dressmaker's forms, a buggy top from 1905, oil stoves, gas chandeliers, rotting suitcases and trunks, radios, furniture, straw hats, stepladders, bottles, and that Model T Ford that we mentioned. In a basement library, searchers discovered 5 baby grand pianos, which filled the 16-by-9-foot room. Along the way, boxes of collected documents were routinely removed for safekeeping. In total, there were 12 rooms and 180 tons of junk to contend with. The third floor took nearly 3 hours to go through and establish that Langley wasn't present. The front door was broken through to gain access to the first floor. A side window broken to get access to the second. Floodlights illuminated areas for those working inside. Searchers discovered that the Collier brothers were protective of their things. Much of it was booby-trapped. Moving certain items could cause a mass of items to fall or a pane of glass to break. Tin cans to jingle, like we mentioned. The commotion would have alerted the brothers to an intruder. Like a spider. One officer triggered what was said to be an avalanche of fluorescent tubes, lumber, papers, and scraps of metal in the main hallway. The falling junk battered him, but he suffered no major injury because of it. Some officers set off another booby trap on the way to the second floor when they disturbed a pile on the stairs that upset 2 75-pound chunks of concrete, crowbars, tin cans, and jars of human waste. It was decided that a top-down approach would be safer, as there were no guarantees that the floors would hold with all the junk and dozens of people now moving around inside the building, not to mention getting smashed with jars of human waste and huge chunks of concrete. Langley wasn't messing around with these booby traps.
As the junk was tossed out, the sanitation department worked to collect it for removal. Almost 6 tons of junk was driven away by 2 trucks. By the end of the day, there were no serious injuries despite the challenges, but Langley remained missing. Rumors and stories about Langley made the rounds. Different shop owners told stories of seeing the missing brother scurrying around like a rat in the night. Other people said that the publicity surrounding the search would ensure that he remained missing until he felt okay to come back. A woman who lived nearby stated that she had spoken to him in February and that he had said that if his brother dies, people should look for him in the river. He never called a doctor for Homer, and so he felt that the authorities might attempt to hold him accountable for his eventual death. Was Langley on the run, hiding out, or did he jump in the river?
Yeah, to be clear on that, yeah, he's saying, I'm going to kill myself when my brother dies because I know that they'll blame me for his death. And the way he's going to do it, yeah, is to jump into the river. It's quite sad. And not only were people talking about how Langley was missing, but many were talking about how the brothers were broke. To back these claims up were reports that Langley looked for food from garbage cans and told some others that he just broke off parts of the food that wasn't good anymore and ate the rest. Another shop owner gave him day-old rolls for a while until Langley stopped coming around. I believe they were just eccentric and confused by the world, Aaron. I know of people with plenty in the bank, but they never spend. They just hoard it, like Langley. If a bag full of garbage seemed precious to him, what would a bank account full of money represent, right? And we haven't delved much into the psychology of the brothers here, but I assume their parents' deaths, then Homer's failing health, had caused a lot of strain on Langley. We mentioned his intelligence, his odd behavior in public, his obvious mental health issues when it comes to the state of the mansion. Hoarding is, simply put, a strong need to save things, an inability to let go. The loss of his parents, then the threat of losing his brother, obviously triggered something in Langley. Who knows exactly what was going on with him? There's no diagnosis when it comes to the troubled younger brother. We could guess, I don't know, things like OCD. Perhaps he was on the spectrum of autism. Maybe he just liked being left alone in a world he no longer recognized. Simple. But one thing's for certain, you don't come across a story like that of the Collier brothers every day, even every century for that matter.
April 1st, 1947. Homer was buried in a sealed oak coffin covered with a wreath made of daffodils, dandelions, and lemon leaves. Over 50 people were in attendance, mostly relatives. A few detectives and a swarm of reporters kept watch. Despite the hope that Langley would show, he never did. A crew of 6 men took over the job of emptying the mansion. At this point, over 100 tons of stuff had been removed, and there remained no sign of the lone Collier brother. The work would continue, of course, but the feeling was that he wasn't going to be located in the house. The hunt was on for Langley Collier. Newspapers spread his picture around, and an eager public went to work immediately. Many people would be accused of being the eccentric hermit. Most would complain and argue with those pointing the accusatory finger at them, and I can't tell you how often, going through these papers, that you would see a little advertisement for a reward for anyone who could locate Langley Collier. And of course, they had a picture of him with and without his mustache in case he tried to obscure his identity.
Wow. I didn't know that. And you know, not to be rude, but any man who fit the description of Langley Collier was likely unhinged or destitute themselves in some way. Langley dressed as if he lived on the streets. So the homeless were being harassed here in search of the elusive Collier brother.
And if a dead body was reported, many would say, that's Langley, only to have the authorities dash their hopes later. A man named Joe Gould was beset with the Daily News reporters who believed that he was indeed Langley. Joe had a bit of fun with the situation, though. He said, they tried to insult me with 2 bottles of ale. I swallowed the insult, then admitted that I am not Langley Collier.
I love the way they talked back then. Poetic. About stealing booze off these guys.
Right.
April 8th, 1947. Searcher H. Walter Skidmore and his assistant Archie Matthews were at the Collier home searching for Langley still when Skidmore smelled something bad and called out, look under that bump of papers there. Archie reached under the papers and replied, Jesus Christ, I've got him by the toe. Langley had dutifully collected the papers for his brother for many years and was finally located under a pile of them. Unbelievably, the location of his body was just 10 feet from where Homer had been found. Langley's body was turned towards where his brother had been in the chair. His arm reached out as if trying to make contact. He had been suffocated under papers that had been booby-trapped. Without the care of his incapacitated younger brother, Homer Collier had slowly died. The two brothers had lived together, alone, and had died the same way, likely conversing until their cruel ends. And what a way to go. Two brothers, marooned in their own mansion, muttering their final hours away, trapped by the circumstances of their own devices.
It's a really important point here, because Langley had talked about how much he loved and respected his older brother. And this idea that he had run away or gone into hiding, really at the end, it seems ridiculous. He never would have abandoned his brother.
That's right. And again, how sad. People hoped that they had time to speak in their last moments. But I mean, if he suffocated underneath those newspapers, my thought is that he was probably gravely injured right off the bat. Yes, he had time to kind of reach out towards his brother. But those final hours, or even if it was days or if it was just minutes, I don't envision them as being romantic in any way, you know, like kind of like a nice way to end the whole mad charade. I see it as very tragic, Aaron. How about you?
It is. But really what it shows you is these Collier brothers weren't really, in the eyes of the public, who they were or who they were thought to be. I mean, they had this vision of these brothers, but it wasn't true. And the fact that they kept looking all over for Langley when he never would have abandoned his brother, well, it just goes to show that it doesn't matter what the truth is. The public knows their truth, and it's not always the same. So we see that even, you know, in today's world.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And they tore down the mansion, right? They tore down the brownstone. It was too, I mean, it was all full of garbage and mold and holes in the walls and everything else. It was falling apart. So they just tore it down, and they made that park that's there that I think a lot of people probably wonder, why is that there? It's like a little pocket park on the edge of the brownstone buildings called the Collier Park. I'm sure there's people who sit in that park and have no idea where they're sitting in the history there, which is incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing is, too, if you wonder why they didn't preserve it, well, one of the people who entered the building, at least one, was spraying themselves with DDT before they went in to search for Langley. I mean, it's ridiculous. That's how gross it was in there. Just imagine all the bugs, the rats, the cats, everything. And nothing was ever cleaned or picked up. So trust me, the park is an improvement.
No
anyway,
doubt.
A very chilling story, Jack.
Oh, what, are you cold? Aaron, would you like a blanket, or I could put on a tee for you, perhaps?
No. That's just weird, Jack.
Oh, right. Right. That is, yeah, it's weird, considering. All right. Well, good night. Good night then, Aaron.
Good night.
Hey, don't get up. I'll blow out all of the candles.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.